Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. President-elect Trump ran his first successful presidential campaign in 2016 on the antagonizing of immigration and immigrants.
Nearly 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records ordered deported from our country are tonight roaming free to threaten peaceful citizens.
Children and parents who lived in fear of deportation under Trump's first administration are most certainly feeling that anxiety return exponentially. Schools, teachers, and administrators meet that anxiety head-on with their daily interaction with immigrant children and the children of immigrants. Psychologists say harsh immigration policies have negative effects on these students, whether or not they're citizens. We're talking today with two researchers who explored how immigration policies under Trump in his first administration disrupted education and student outcomes, particularly in schools that serve poor communities. Dr. Jung Yeon Lee, or Joy as she's also called, is an associate professor in the School of Education at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. Dr. Patricia Gandara is a research professor and the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at the University of California, Los Angeles. Lee and Gandara are editors of the book Schools Under Siege, The Impact of Immigration Enforcement on Educational Equity, published in 2021, when the world was in the throes of a pandemic and the nation was freshly into a Democratic administration that was attempting to reverse many of Trump's immigration executive orders. Gandara explains why she and Lee felt the need to do this kind of research.
For decades, I've studied immigrant children mostly through the lens of language, English learners. How do they fare in their schools? How do we treat them? How do we educate them? And it was becoming increasingly apparent that language was not the most important thing anymore in these students' lives. Their well-being, their welfare in the face of these tremendously harmful policies for immigrant families was affecting the students. And today, even a few years ago, more than 90% of these children are born in the U.S. They're U.S. citizens. And yet they were suffering so much from the immigration policies as though they were not even citizens themselves. So Joy and I wanted to take a look and see what was actually happening in the schools with these kids. And it's a fairly horrifying story. I was so glad that you picked up on the notion that this is happening all over again. And so we know from our research exactly how this is going to play out.
We've seen throughout the history of this nation, and there's even a chapter in this book that sort of goes through immigration policy, the history of it in the U.S. Joy, can you talk a little bit about how you thought it was important to include that history of immigration policies, of racism against immigrants, because it's been directed at different racial groups, it appears, or different ethnic groups for the last 250 years of this nation. This time around, it seems to be focused mostly on people of color who come from Latin American countries, from Afro-Latino countries, Haiti. Whenever there are people of colors, particularly those who are darker skinned, it seems like this time around they appear to be the target.
In retrospect, when we were collecting data and writing the book and journal article, we didn't really focus on Asian or African students specifically, but I want to highlight this now. The students and families affected by aggressive immigration enforcement, they are not just from Latinx or Hispanic communities. There is a significant percentage of Asian and Black immigrants you just mentioned who are undocumented and affected by immigration enforcement activities as well. And while they may not have crossed the border by walking. Many of them came to the United States due to economic challenges, civil wars, or climate changes in their home countries. And even for those who came here from all the proper legal documentations with a refugee status and everything, unexpected situations like falling victim to scams or having a sponsor or business owner go bankrupt can leave them undocumented and therefore can be affected by immigration enforcement activities. And in fact, statistics show that 1 in 7 Asians in the United States is undocumented. And going back to the Trump administration in the past, specifically targeted and derogatory rhetoric, like Kung Flu, China virus, those kind of negative remarks led to a substantial increase in anti-Asian hate and racism. And I think everybody remembers that. And these kinds of remarks and specifically normalization of divisive language during his campaign and under his administration in the past encouraged people to otherize people around them and in our communities. But what we really need to focus on is the fact that we are very much alike and how we all come to this country with dreams, how we work hard to contribute to our community, society, and the nation, and how we sacrifice for our families. And by going over the history of these shared struggles and shared dreams, we want to highlight that we are very much alike. And public schools are one of the very few spaces where those dreams can come true for the next generations and young people. And that's why public schools must remain a safe and a protective space that should be free from any kind of disruptions of aggressive immigration enforcement. And they should be the last and front line of defense for many families and communities.
Well, Patricia, it's pointed out in this book that it's really kind of up to the schools to shape the lives of these immigrant children, but there are struggles within the schools. You know, each state determines the fate of each of the district and the rules and regulations that it must follow. And so teachers now have to face this incredible burden on making sure that these immigrant children or children of immigrants are set up in a path to success, and yet there really isn't much information given to them on how they need to be aware of the latest immigration policies, of why ICE might be showing up or waiting at the doors of the school or at bus stops. Can you talk a little bit about how teachers and districts have taken on this really almost incredible burden that is probably even adding more to the lack of retention in schools? Teachers already under such incredible stress right now as it is, and now this is added on top of that.
We also have a chapter in the book that focuses on Title I schools. Those are the schools that serve the poorest children in our nation. And that's where we find the biggest problems, because they already have so many challenges with the communities in which they're sited. And then to have this immigration enforcement on top of that makes the schools extremely vulnerable. And there hasn't been enough attention paid to this.
Can you briefly explain what a Title I school is?
Yeah, Title I schools are schools in which a significant percentage of the students going to those schools are living in poverty and therefore are not able to take full advantage of the education that is provided. And so the federal government provides some additional funding for these schools to help even things out. But it doesn't, because they don't come near to having the kinds of resources that a middle-class school has. And so these are the schools that are already struggling in communities of poverty. And then they have this overlay of frightening prospect of immigration enforcement. And as Joey and I were looking at the data, we were realizing that people weren't understanding that these are the schools overwhelmingly that are affected by these kinds of immigration enforcement policies.
Well, Joy, the enforcement policies that Trump undertook in his first administration when he was elected in 2016, a lot of those policies were reversed or had attempted to be reversed under the Biden administration. Did you notice, since the publication of this book, which was right at the very beginning of the Biden administration, have you been able to notice if there had been any difference in the outcome of students under the Biden administration as there were under the Trump administration?
Let me share one statistic. So one of the statistics we report that was from Department of Homeland Security in number of non-citizens removals, returns, and expulsions from 1892 to 2022. And under the Biden administration, the number has sharply decreased when it comes to the number of citizens who have been removed or were deported from the United States. And that means immigration enforcement activities under the Biden administration that was less aggressive and that was targeted, focusing on criminals or those who have criminal records. And that also affected our school communities. We haven't heard that many horrifying or frightening stories and experiences, observations from teachers. I mean, the teacher education department and I work with a wide range of different teachers who are in public schools, charter schools, and private schools. During the past years, I haven't heard a lot of concerns or struggles from the teacher candidates that I work with compared to the observations or experiences reported back then under the Trump administration. And I think there is some substantial difference between the two administrations in the past.
Joy E. is an associate professor in the School of Education at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. Patricia Gandara is a research professor and the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at the University of California, Los Angeles. They are editors of the book Schools Under Siege, The Impact of Immigration Enforcement on Educational Equity. When we come back, the U.S. has depended on immigration to sustain its economy. Patricia Gandara says mass deportation plans would place the country on a backward path.
The United States has always depended on immigration for its welfare. In the last few decades, we have had a significant problem that we're not replacing ourselves with native-born individuals.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. President-elect Trump says he has plans in place to start mass deportations on day one of his presidency.
I will invoke the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. Think of that. The Republican platform promises to launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country. We must use any and all resources needed to stop the invasion, including moving thousands of troops currently stationed overseas.
The devastating family separations that stained Trump's first term are essentially a certainty, according to Tom Homan, Trump's soon-to-be border czar. Here's what he told 60 Minutes in November.
Is there a way to carry out mass deportation without separating families?
Of course there's. Families can be deported together.
Why should a child who is an American citizen have to pack up and move to a country that they don't know?
Could their parent absolutely enter the country illegally, had a child knowing he was in the country illegally, so he created that crisis.
students in immigrant and mixed-status families suffered fear, intimidation, and family separation under the first administration. Trump's promised hardline crackdown promises to leave an even deeper psychological scar in the lives of students and their educators. Educational researchers Patricia Gandara and Joy E. edited the book Schools Under Siege, The Impact of Immigration Enforcement on Educational Equity. It explores how the first Trump administration's immigration policies contributed to increased absenteeism, decreased student achievement, and parental disengagement. Educators were witness to how these immigration policies impacted students' mental health and educational outcomes between 2016 and 2020. Gandara says teachers and students are bracing themselves for uncertainty.
We have every reason to believe that families and students and schools and teachers are experiencing once again what they did under the last Trump administration. Because if anything, the Trump folks are saying now that there's no problem with getting rid of millions of immigrants because they'll just take the whole family. And so many of these individuals, as we noted, most of the children, the young people, are born here. They're citizens. This is the only country that they know. They don't know any other country. And for a good number of them, they don't know any other language either. So it appears that the Trump administration to come will just be deporting families en masse. And of course, everybody is concerned. And while this is brand new and we don't yet have data on it, I think that we have every reason to believe that the same kinds of shockwaves are going through these communities that went through on the last time with Trump, but even perhaps even more so, because this is made to be the single most important activity of this new administration is deporting immigrants. So we have every reason to believe that these communities are extremely upset and worried. And of course, you know, one of the really sad things was what teachers told us about students in their classrooms who were the best students, really talented students who had lots of dreams for going to college and becoming something important. And yet they were now saying that there was really no point in their studying. There was no point in their coming to school because their futures were now so uncertain. And we suspect that that's exactly what many of these students are feeling like today.
And Joy, a lot of these immigrants, young people and adults who may be targeted, are recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, where they are temporarily deferred from deportation. And so the government has all this information because they had to provide it in order to receive these protections. And so many of these DACA recipients are educators themselves with children who are U.S. citizens. How do you see the potential mass deportation? I know the logistics are still incredibly fuzzy as to how that could happen, but if it does, how do you foresee this affecting the educational system across the country?
I would say in a very catastrophic way. As the nation, we have been experiencing substantial teacher shortage for years and years. And as you said, some of DACA students, and actually a good number of DACA recipients, they are educators, and they work in different parts of public education system as educators, counselors, to different capacity. But under the Biden administration, the policies around DACA recipients, they have not changed that much. And if those DACA recipients, if they submitted their renewal applications, it takes years and years for them to renew their DACA status. And I think under the Trump administration, they are not going to accept any new applications. That's going to be affecting our public schools, including DACA recipient students and educators and workers who are part of our public education system in a very catastrophic way. I'm immensely concerned about that.
Patricia, Trump has also promised to do away with the Department of Education, and there is talk here in Texas of the government wanting to overturn Plyer versus Doe. That is the Supreme Court case that ensured that every student, whether or not they were U.S. citizens, had a right to a free public education. Can you share your thoughts about that?
Yeah, let me just start with the framing notion here that the United States has always depended on immigration for its welfare. In the last few decades, we have had a significant problem that we're not replacing ourselves with native-born individuals. In other words, the economy is actually at risk when we lose immigrants. We are dependent upon them. And so this is so incredibly short-sighted for the welfare of the country as well as the welfare of everyone, because we need immigrants. As we push immigrants away from this country, our birth rate is declining, and we have no place else to go to increase the numbers of individuals in the country who can contribute to the economy. So we're doing an enormous disservice to ourselves, to those of us who are here in this nation. With respect to Plyler, that decision in 1982 by the Supreme Court was based on the notion that it makes no sense for anybody to not educate children and to leave them without the skills to be able to grow up and contribute to the economy and contribute to themselves. And so Plyler was about not creating a separate class of individuals that were uneducated and unable to take care of themselves. That would do nothing more than create more harm to the country. It's an issue of really shooting yourself in the foot by not educating these children. But just in a very mean-spirited way, there's been more discussion recently about going to the Supreme Court, which Trump has created, basically, and trying to overturn the Plyler decision, which would leave these children without any access to education. That doesn't do anybody any good.
Well, as we pointed out, the education of students is essentially under the purview of the state. And your book actually does include a really positive look at how some schools actually really go out of their way to make sure that their immigrant students feel welcome. They even have oftentimes an immigrant lawyer there, or a lawyer who is a specialist in immigration law, who can help keep students and educators and parents informed of all the latest information. Joy, can you tell us a little bit about those kinds of schools that are actually serving as sanctuaries, and perhaps about what you think their future might be under this next administration?
In one of the chapters of our book, we talked about very special and unique models of schooling that is called community schools or wraparound schools, things like that, where students can have access to different types of service, not just education, healthy meals, counseling, healthcare, and other different types of service they need. And not just for students, for families as well. There's more and more schools can provide this kind of a wraparound service that's really serving the community, not just a group of students, their families and community members and neighborhood participants, individuals who live in the community and share the community together. So that was one type of model we introduced in our chapter, and we heard really positive stories and empowering stories from educators working at community schools.
This raises the issue, too. As Joy and I got into these collecting data, we had kind of assumed that the policies in deeply red states, very conservative states, that the schools would be responding differently to these kids than in blue states or more progressive states. One of the things that was stunning to us was the extent to which the schools and the administrators in the schools were providing support for these students in ways that was very surprising to us in deeply red states, states that had very conservative policies. Nonetheless, their administrators in the schools were looking out for these children and these families in a very similar way to those in states that were much more supportive of immigration. So what we came to the conclusion that the people in the schools care about the kids, and what their own personal feelings may be about immigration policy, the welfare of the children came first. And it was amazing to us to see the kinds of things that people were doing in states that were really cracking down on immigration.
So I would like to know if you have any words you'd like to share with maybe some educators or teachers or students, parents, administrators who have some trepidation into what's in store here under this next administration. Things seem to be a lot more uncertain now than they were 8 years ago. But this time around, there seems to be a lot more in place to where Trump might be able to maneuver the system where he can accomplish a lot of what he has been trying to accomplish with immigration policy. So obviously, people listening who might be a little nervous, parents especially, children especially, what would you want to say to them who are living with this uncertainty?
Well, I'm really hoping that what we saw happening in school districts across the country during the last Trump administration, with people really stepping up to protect these families and these children, will happen again. One of the stories that I recall that really impressed me was a superintendent in one district, in a very red state, by the way, in which the state policies were anti-immigrant, was talking about how people in the community came together to support these families because they were part of their community. They knew these people. And one woman in particular that he referred to had said, well, I didn't realize when they were talking about throwing out immigrants that they meant this family. They're our friends. We know them. We don't want them to be thrown out. So I'm hoping that people on the ground are going to show up in numbers and make it very clear that this is wrong. This is just terribly wrong. And that it's not only hurtful to these immigrants, it's hurtful to us as a nation. I expect that people like Joy and myself and a whole lot of other people will be organizing to combat this since we know what to expect now.
I want to add one more example that we collected from our study participants, and that statement that is from a superintendent in a very conservative state in the West. And the person said, my philosophy is let's remove the adult from the picture and let's just do good things for kids. I just keep the focus on the kids, and it's all about the kids. And I think that's the central point we want to make as educational researchers. And I hope this message goes to other educators in every part of our communities across the nation, whether they are in red state, blue state. Our job is, our service is to serve our students and their families in a caring way, in a fair way, and in a good way. And I think that's something we cannot forget as we serve our students in our public education system.
Norma, I'm just so pleased that you picked up on this because, of course, you know, as soon as it became apparent what was happening in these elections, I'm sure for Joy, like myself, I immediately thought back about this work that we did and how it had become totally relevant all over again. Because we know what happens under these circumstances. We know about kids who tried to commit suicide. We know about kids who, excellent students, who just drop out of school who had tremendous possibilities of contributing to the country, who will no longer be able to. So we can help shed some light on how to prepare the schools and the students and the families for what's to come.
Dr. Patricia Gandara is a research professor and the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at the University of California, Los Angeles. Dr. Jungyeon Yi is an associate professor in the School of Education at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. They are the editors of the book Schools Under Siege, The Impact of Immigration Enforcement on Educational Equity. It was published in 2021 in the wake of Donald Trump's loss to President Biden and when the nation was neck deep in a pandemic. The Immigration Institute at Harvard published a policy briefing in 2020 based on the book Schools Under Siege. We've linked to it in both English and Spanish at tpr.org. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Maria Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.